Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of Business Munchies, where we munch on some business ideas. We have Sajal Khantar with us today. He's a former investment banker who started a daily newsletter called The Boring News Company. Their whole point is to take the sensationalism out of our daily news. Check it out, the link is in the description. Lastly, if you haven't already, please join our No Spam WhatsApp group for the latest updates on everything about the Indian Dream. We have more than 1600 founders and entrepreneurs learning new business ideas and opportunities on our group every week, and we'd love to have you too. The link is in the show notes. Okay, Sajal, what's the first idea you have for us?
Hey, Sahil. Hey, Sid. I think the first idea that I want to discuss is how do you create trust in a marketplace, right? So you have your businesses like Udaan, you know, back in the day you had ShopClues. Biggest problem over there is these businesses are trying to simplify a lot of problems that are already solved, right, from a logistical perspective. But they're not solving the problem of trust. So I want to create a LinkedIn for small businesses where the community is verified. And its job is to help other members of the community try and find mutual links and figure out whether somebody's trustworthy to do business with or not. Because once somebody trusts another person or another business, then you can have multiple transactions. So building an entire ecosystem around here and then having the marketplace model to monetize in various ways is what I think would make a lot of sense.
Yeah. You're 100% right, right? One of the biggest problems in the small and medium business sector is the credit problem, where you end up working with someone who is not going to pay you on time or is going to pay you, you know, 120 days, 180 days, which is why it's really hard to get new clients. You end up working with just the set of clients that you're comfortable with and you've been working for years, which is great, but you don't have any growth per se. So if there is any way to verify that this person, through a review system, through, you know, crowdsourcing that information, where this person has been paying on time 90% of the times, right?
So the credit problem is actually kind of solved because Dun & Bradstreet DNB, which, you know, has those credit ratings. So they also have a product for this. I don't remember what it's called, but it's crowdsourced information where you get access to their system, which tells you how fast a certain company pays, and in return you get that, and in return you have to give them your information on your debtor list on how which company has not paid and how much time.
What size of companies though? I would think DNB is larger.
I mean, we have worked with them, and I don't know if they have a minimum size of company for this.
Yeah, I do think the 2 to 40 50 crore 60 crore turnover range, I think this problem is acute there. I don't know if DNB solves for that. And something like what Sajal is talking about, a marketplace where you could verify, you could sort of, you know, list about what's the good thing about working with these people and stuff like that, crowdsourced information, that could deter some people from like just messing around for the sake of messing around, right? Like there are some people who will just not pay you for ages.
So Sajal, what kind of information did you want on this marketplace?
Yeah, so I mean, the two types of verification that you need to do, right? One is like, does the company actually exist? Because that's actually a really big problem, especially when you consider spaces like textiles, where, you know, people are listing themselves on IndiaMart and Trade India, and then those businesses just don't exist. So yes, your marketplace may solve for like, for example, if you buy something in, you know, because you bought it from a fraudulent company on the marketplace, maybe they'll reimburse you. But that's not what we're trying to solve for here. It's not about, we're not trying to solve the problem of, I hope I don't get cheated on. We're trying to solve the problem of how can I trust somebody else so I can really scale my business. Because what you need is 2-3 vendors who, you know, really help you out because they like you. And then payment terms and everything else becomes flexible. Because if you don't have that flexibility in business, you can't really grow. So for stage one verification, I think we can do ourselves, because I came across a lot of startups who provide these services where they'll go and mine all the government servers and pull out like a proper 20-page report for you on who the directors of the company are, what their balance sheet is like, paid in capital, whatnot, right?
Their address, the director's address is shockingly important, because in case you get a check that bounces, you need to have their address. Otherwise, you can't send a legal notice.
Exactly, right? But you know, that this check bouncing thing is also like, if you ask people who are already, who've been in this, these traditional industries for decades, they're like, this is not a good deterrent.
Yeah.
People are like, yeah, I mean, sure, man, let's check bounce and we'll see what happens. You and I will fight a case in Indian courts for 45 years.
Yeah, you're 100% right.
Yeah, and the second level of trust is about verification, right? So today, how is it being done? Traditionally, what people will do is they'll say, hey, look, go ask somebody in the market about my firm and you will get a reference. Or they, when they're getting when they're having the introductory call, they're trying to figure out where there's a mutual connection. So both parties can say, okay, you know, this is a gold standard party. What do you do this? What do you do with this kind of a system is you bring this online. Now, I will connect the both of you for free. For example, if I want to monetize this, I'll say, look, I'll connect you to a third party, Sajal, who knows both Sid and Siddharth. And appropriately, you guys can then have a phone call and a discussion or, you know, and if you do this, I give you some extra points, which you can use to for another third-party service within this ecosystem. And so you helping keep the quality of the community clean is benefiting your business directly, and that is why you would do it.
Yeah, and you could do it. You could actually build this vertical-wise in a way, right? Like, as you said, like textiles, just focus on textiles, get textiles right, then move on to another sector. And there are multiple big sectors where you can create this. On the point of verification, by the way, I used to work for a lending company that was lending to a lot of SMEs. And there was a full blown process on like credit check and interviews and all of that to decide if we want to lend them money or not. But the last stage was reference checks. So we talked to their suppliers, we talked to a couple of their customers. And if there was a ratio of like, if there were X number of negative, regardless of the, of how good the balance sheet is and how good, you know, everything else was, we used to just not give them the loan, right? So reference checks is huge in this space, because that's really where you try and figure out the character of the business and the promoter, right? And if you could automate this in somehow, because the biggest challenge when you're looking for references is you got to ask the person that you're doing a reference check on who should I talk to, right? At least that's what we used to do. And there's so much chances of them giving you, like, you know, people that they already have good relationships with, and the whole point sort of gets defeated. So we used to try and do blind reference checks, but not that easy to find those people.
I mean, you could boil down this entire thing, Sajal's entire idea, to just reference checks for B2B. Like, how do you improve that entire system?
That won't be a unicorn then, you know. What you need to think about is a couple of things, right? One is you're helping digitize these businesses. So maybe you create a survey form which helps them create their profile online, right? And you do it sector-wise, so it's not like Just Dial, where, you know, you've created a profile which for metals and textiles is the same. So as you go sector-wise, right, I think you can create certain unique features for each of those sectors. And the second thing that you do is, well, right now it's about, okay, you are actively looking for supplier. Once your community is of a certain scale and size, you can start actively recommending connections. You can start telling people who's been viewing your profile, because we love checking that stuff on LinkedIn, right? And then you provide logistical support to actually make the meetings happen physically. Like, hey, I'll book your hotel, I'll book your travel, get you from your office in Mumbai to your office in Ludhiana, to your potential customer's office in Ludhiana. And by the way, we can have this newsfeed feature in there as well, so that people can start connecting with each other, or they know about certain kinds of listings or queries or whatever it is, right? I think that's how you scale this into a proper, fully functioning with network effects to a business media platform, social media / business media platform.
Yeah. The thing with social media and with marketplace businesses is that they're really tough to get off the ground, because, you know, getting those first, like on the buyer side, on the seller side, getting those first 10, 20 people is tough. And I think, like Siddharth said, if you focus on one particular niche, hopefully you'll be able to go deep enough into that niche so that you can start getting people from either side. There's this really good newsletter that came out recently by Lenny's newsletter about how to start building a marketplace business. I think Sajal is Googling it right now. And the first step, he says, is that, you know, even if you're the eventual goal is to be as wide as possible, first pick a niche and really go deep into that niche as much as possible. It can be a geographical niche, it can be a niche in terms of business vertical. But yeah, first really go deep into that niche, and that will help you scale enough there, and then you can start going everywhere else. And then he also says that start on the supply side first before going on the demand side. Because then the supply brings the demand.
I like, for example, me personally, I would just start off with textiles. That entire supply chain is so complex. There's so many different types of players, and it's a game of price and branding. So it's got enough suppliers that you could think of it as agriculture, right? Nobody is unique, but then everybody's somehow unique. And when you speak to people in the textile business, everybody thinks they have some amazing business secret that makes their business super unique. They've got some supplier or some customer or something that they're doing, but the reality is everybody's doing the same thing.
And there are so many layers in textile. You think you found a manufacturer, but no. They're just another distributor. Like, there's so many layers that you have to go through before you find the actual manufacturer.
Yeah, whenever you see a business which says manufacturers and creators and wholesalers, that you should know they don't manufacture any.
Yeah. All right, should we move to the next idea?
Yeah.
Okay. I'll do mine because it is going to be the most unique in this episode.
That's what you think.
I hope so. Okay, so I was listening to another podcast about Berkshire Hathaway by these guys at Acquired. It's a fantastic podcast, you should listen to it. And they found a website called berkshirenerds.com. So the only thing that Berkshire Nerds does is they sell bronze busts of Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger. For those of you who don't know, Charlie Munger is Warren Buffett's partner in Berkshire Hathaway. And they sell each one of these busts for $1,300, which is around 1 lakh. And you can get a set of both of them for $2,500, which is around 2 lakhs. And it's that's it. That's it. They don't do anything else. I tried to Google the revenue that this business makes. Sadly, I could not find it. I would have loved to know how much this business makes. I'm just imagining, can't you do the same thing for India? Can't you just do like a Ratan Tata bronze bust, and it can be like a gift item, right? Like, or can you, your market can be interior designers, and you price it at 50,000 rupees. I think there are enough people in the business world who'd be willing to pay 50,000 rupees for a bust of Ratan Tata in their office, or Rakesh Jhunjhunwala, or Mukesh Ambani, or Dhirubhai Ambani, or something like
none
that.
None of right? this is going to work. The only thing that's going to work in India is Narendra Modi. That's it. Make that happen and you're going to make money. Like, none of these businessmen, they don't have like the fandom that the prime minister has, man.
Okay, chill. Narendra Modi plus Amit Shah set for 1 lakh. How will that work? Just like very focused on that.
Yeah, I think it could work.
Yeah, for 100%. If anything, the BJP, the cash at BJP party themselves may buy a ton of these to say that, hey, you know, there's so much fandom and fiefdom around Narendra Modi and Amit Shah. Very possible. You know, actually, I was one of the Berkshire nerds. I went for the Berkshire Hathaway AGM. And the way I was in college, so the way I tried to fund the trip was buy a lot of merchandise from there. So they put up this stall where they have just Berkshire Hathaway merchandise. Like, I bought this pair of boxers from there, which have every single Berkshire Hathaway company listed on it. You know, so there are like a ton of these products. I bought a lot of them with a friend of mine, and then I went and sold them on eBay at like 2x, 3x markup, and funded my entire trip doing this.
Nice. This is in Omaha, right? You have to go to Omaha every year.
Yeah. It's crazy. I mean, it's a cult of Warren Buffett fans.
So do I need to buy you one of these busts as a thank you for coming here? This is going to be our most expensive guest ever. We've never paid anybody.
I think the last word that you said is extremely important. In order for this to work, it needs to be a cult, right? And honestly, like, jokes aside, I think what the PM has been able to do in terms of like just fan following or like people, number of people who are like absolute believers, I think it could definitely work there. It could work for a few other people in the country also. But
so who has such a rabid fan following except for the PM?
I think you'll have to go Bollywood.
Cricketers in Bollywood.
Yeah.
Right? Sachin Tendulkar.
So Amir Khan, Shah Rukh Khan, yeah. Salman Khan. The thing is, Salman Khan's following is more tier 2, tier 3. So I don't know if they'll pay for a 50,000 rupee bust of Salman Khan.
I think they'd be more likely.
Maybe.
To be honest.
Or just his right bicep.
with that thing that he wears on his wrist, some sort of whatever he wears.
But First of all, before we move on, one piece of information for you guys. You know who made this website? Tiny Capital. The same company that owns all these other companies made this bloody website. It's a silly side project. But so when I was on the website, I tried to find out the weight of the these bronze busts so that I could see how much profit margin they've put on top, but I couldn't find it. But it actually leads me to another topic where I read this the other day that copper is going to be the new oil, right? So for the people who don't know, for the people who are listening and who don't know, I work in the electrical manufacturing business. So that means that we buy a ton of oil. When I say ton of copper, that's an understatement. We buy tons of copper every month and we follow the copper price very regularly on a daily basis. And in the last couple of months, the copper price has really shot up. It's currently around $9,400 per ton. And I just read a Goldman Sachs report that it's supposed to go up to $15,000 per ton over the next couple of years. The reason for that is because of huge demand from the EV market and other kind of like electrical appliances markets, which are going to really shoot up because of the rise of EVs and the replacement of combustion engine cars. So where I'm going with this is that if you're not already in some kind of copper-based business like copper casting, bronze casting, brass casting, or if you don't own a copper mine, now might be a good time to buy a copper mine or to get into these kind of businesses, because the demand is going to go through the roof in the next couple of years. The current suppliers will not be able to meet that demand in the next couple of years. I've visited a lot of brass and bronze casting units in Jamnagar and Rajkot. They're really small. They're very unorganized. I'm sure somebody who's listening can do a better job than they are doing right now.
I like how you very casually mentioned just go out and buy a copper mine. As if you could just like wake up today and be like, okay, what should I do today? I should buy a copper mine today. And another point, I have a couple of copper bottles, water bottles. Should I consider them as long-term investments now? What am I supposed to do?
Yeah, keep it. 50% appreciation on your copper bottles in the next 2 years.
But I was also reading on the same lines that a part of this rise that has happened in the last 9 months to a year, would you attribute that to just like commodity inflation because of how much dollar has been printed in the US, or do you think that's not connected to this?
It's very difficult to say what is because of the US Fed, what is actual demand, but there is definitely going to be a rise in demand because of EV. There's no doubt about it. Short term, I can't say, but I think that long term demand increase is definitely going to be there because the supply is still constrained, right? Because of how much can come out of copper mines in Chile, in Jharkhand, or wherever. But the demand is definitely going to increase in the medium to long term, in my opinion.
For businesses like yours that use this as a core raw material, it must pose a significant challenge, right? Because when prices are stable, you know fairly sure what the margins are going to be and what you should be pricing your goods at. But let's say if they keep increasing, how do you really price it in and how do you manage this?
Yeah, so that's a really interesting question. So we constantly change our prices based on the current copper prices. So if we tell them that these prices are valid only in this band. So as long as they place the order within the time when the price is in that band, then we'll accept the order. If it's outside that band, then we'll have to say like, sorry, man, this we can't accept it. And as soon as the order is given, then we get the advance, then we place the order with our supplier at a certain price. People also do hedging, where they will hedge that, hey, like 6 months from now, I will buy copper from you at this price. But hedging is obviously a little bit more risky. I prefer, because I'm not a risky investment banker like Sajal. I prefer the method of just like when you get the order, that's when you buy the raw material.
I'm a Warren Buffett fan. I'm all about buy low, sell high. Yeah, all about value. So, you know, definitely the investment banker is just an agent who helps you buy and sell at whatever price you as the buyer or seller wants to do a transaction. We really don't do much. It's a very fancy title for an agent.
You're another kind of distributor that I need to find a way to get rid of in the future.
No, I'm like a middleman that, at least I was a middleman that seems to be the new fashion statement in the business world. We eliminate middlemen. Whoever can eliminate bankers will save a ton in fees.
Blockchain,
maybe it'll help with a lot of like automatable functions, but I don't know how you can replace them from a mergers and acquisitions standpoint.
Yeah, you need somebody in the middle to sort of just help the negotiation and communication. I think that's so subjective. There's no system who could just like automate that. And I think that's where investment bankers are just going to keep earning the fees that they earn.
It's a cult where they've all decided that they're never going to take down price. They won't get into a price war with each other. It's like the cola wars, right? You know, Pepsi and Coke never fought on price. They always fought on something different, which is what you think about the food delivery and, sorry, I digress, but you think about the food delivery landscape and you think about the on-demand shared economy in terms of Uber and Ola. The problem there is they got into a price war, which is why profitability will take a lot longer to achieve than it did for the cola guys who are selling sugar water.
I mean, I could go on a rant and I will, I guess. This is also sort of induced by the capital that you take on, right? Because it comes with the cost of like growth at all costs. And one of the easiest way to grow is to throw discount coupons. Swiggy and Zomato did this to each other for the longest time and hurt each other. I think, as you said, probably took the entire industry's profitability for a toss. And if I don't know if you guys noticed this, Amazon entered this race of food delivery very recently, at least in Bangalore. And food that you get on Zomato for, let's say, 160, 200 bucks, on Swiggy for 160, 180 bucks, is now available on Amazon for 80 bucks, right? So it's discount wars 3.0. We'll see if people shift to Amazon, because this is a fairly easy switch to make. Switching costs are not that high. Just open the app, and once you're set up with your address and cards and everything, the experience is seamless across the board. So if you're going to be, it'll be interesting to see if Amazon can sort of make a dent in.
Well, what's going to end up, I actually spend a lot of time on the food delivery space. I think these are really shitty businesses, but I have changed my opinion since I worked on that. I worked on Just Eat Takeaway buying Grubhub. And I will tell you, this is one of the most fascinating businesses out there. You can have EBITDA margins of 40, 50% if you get it right, which is what you're seeing with certain pockets of profitability. So what ends up happening in such businesses is it's survival of the fittest. Reason why they're throwing discounts around is a function of, okay, let me get to as much scale as possible as quickly, because I'll monetize and get profitability later on. It doesn't matter. But I need to be one of the two guys who's surviving. And better if I'm the guy who leads the market versus being the number two, because then I'm a price setter. And habits are created over 10 years. So, you know, we're like in the middle of this cycle. So it's another 5 years of awesome discounts for all of us before we get so used to food delivery that we think of that cost as being normal. At which point there are going to be certain cities. It's a very local business. So there are certain cities which have great profitability metrics because they have this takeout culture, and certain cities where you're forcing the takeout culture with your logistical sort of asset that you have in terms of making deliveries easier, right? So for example, if Bangalore is a city where takeouts are always common before food delivery, that's going to be a great business. That's going to be a great city for you to earn 50% margins.
On the habit creation, me personally, right, I think 4 years back, I would at least check the delivery fee and be like, why are they charging me like a 30, 40, 50 bucks or whatnot? But I've gotten to a point where it's so normal for me to just not even look at the delivery fee, right? Like they'll charge me what they charge me, can't really do much. And I've now started tipping these people. So that's, you know, that's additional income for these drivers and to be attached to the platform. I 100% agree, man. I think it's become second nature to me. I don't think I can live without food delivery now. And I think that's true for a lot of Indians.
I just want to say one last thing about this before we move on. When we did the entire Cloud Kitchen deep dive, the trends article on Cloud Kitchen, I started feeling really bad for restaurants because of the high marketing fee that these food delivery apps take. And as much as I want to not buy from these apps, I have to. But I would rather just go to the restaurant, take away, and come back. But it's just so convenient to take it from the app.
Yeah, man. I mean, you're living in Bombay, right? Like, if it's a restaurant close by, sure. But if it's a restaurant 20 minutes away, you don't want to be stuck in traffic for 40, 50 minutes. You're not going to be going on your bike to just like wiggle through the traffic and all of that, right?
Yeah, I feel bad. Anyway, Sajal, I think your next idea was related to food anyways. So let's go.
Yeah. The idea is to create a concept business called 50-50. Where you create a healthy variant and an unhealthy variant of the same dish, and your distribution model to avoid rent, which is one of the most expensive food costs, right, from a restaurant's perspective, is to have a network of carts. You have a network of carts spread out through the city. You have multiple variations of dishes so that a friend who has a very unhealthy diet and a friend who has a very healthy diet can eat together. So you're trying to cater to everybody in the market versus splitting yourself off into saying I'm a restaurant that caters only to people who like Italian food, only people who like Mexican food. The idea then is to involve tracking and analytics, where you give people an app, you incentivize them to make it easy to find which cart is in your location where you are currently, because the carts are always on the move. And while you're doing this, you tell them what they ate, what is truly the amount of calories consumed, what is truly the amount of protein that you got. And then you can build in some fun elements like, hey, you know, you've been eating healthy for the last 5 days. Here's a cheat day.
You could market this really well, right? Like, I think the concept itself lends to a brilliant marketing campaign of sorts. Are these going to be, so you said movable carts, so you just place them depending on where you'll see traffic, and hence you don't waste money on a fixed rent at being at one location where the traffic could be just be during the day if it's an office complex and stuff like that. You just sort of move it around so that it's more efficient, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, if you think about it, say you have a restaurant in a popular office building, right? You're limited to your capacity. So some people will form lines if the product is really, really good. But after a certain point, people are just going to be like, you know what, it's fine. Today, I don't have to eat the best food. I'll eat the second best food where the line is shorter. But when you have a cart system, what you can do is you can send multiple carts to demand zones. So over time, you get smarter and you know which area, maybe Indranagar in Bangalore is, you know, popping with a lot of startups. 2 p.m. everybody wants to eat. That's when you send a bunch of carts.
You need to be careful. Rahul Dravid might attack you in Instagram. But question about this. As I understand it, for these carts and like these street vendors, at least in Bombay, you need a license that is for that specific location and for the specific food that's being sold. I'm correct about that, right? I think. How can you move around?
I think, yes, you do have a license for location. So maybe that might create certain kinds of geographical limits. But anyways, if you have a person who is moving the cart around, they won't be able to get beyond 1 to 2 kilometers anyways. And then when it comes to the laws, the reality is you need to create a value proposition that's so profound that eventually the government changes the laws. So that's what Uber did. And that's what we do if we implement this food cart idea.
No, so I know someone who started their food truck business about 7 years ago. And what Sajal is saying is absolutely right. There were no laws around food trucks back then, or just gray area. And they were able to sort of, at least in the city that they were operating in, they were able to get the required permits with just hustling. I know it was a lot of like just going back and forth with the administration. But I do think that's possible. And then food trucks are possible, then so are these carts, right? Because the concept remains the same.
Yeah. And then the way you turn this into a unicorn, I know I say this with all my ideas, is you make the carts autonomous over time. So either you develop the technology in-house or you're able to find some company in the US, because I think 90% of all autonomous developments happening over there. License the technology, autonomize your carts, and you know, you can change the face of real estate this way. Because all of a sudden, your location doesn't matter. Now what you should do is buy these carts and get them as a part of our network. And then you can commoditize these carts and allow investors to make money on certain carts that they want to bet on. Like the cart that caters to Indranagar, right? I want a yield on that cart. So that's how you make it a $1 billion business.
I love it.
I was actually reading, I was watching a TV show yesterday about James May from Top Gear in Japan. And it's actually pretty fun. Sure, you should watch it. It's on Amazon Prime. But in one episode, he was at a sushi restaurant somewhere in Tokyo, and the entire process of making the sushi was automized. So a robot would just like roll the rice, and then a robot would roll the maki or the seaweed on top of the rice and like do the entire sushi thing automated. So yeah, your vans, they just need the raw ingredients, and they can even make the food themselves, maybe for like easy stuff like bhel. You just have to like...
The initial thing is pick things that you don't have to cook, right? Pick things that you can just mix and toss and serve. So bhel and salads is your first 50-50 concept. And there's so many varieties and variations just in bhel and salads. That alone can take you, you know, very, very far in terms of creating a large menu.
Dude, I have a feeling that these poor robots are going to get attacked, and we're going to find them in some random area.
Strip for parts. I think that's the biggest.
For parts.
That's the first concern that you. That's the first thing you probably have to solve for. It's just like those bounce scooter helmets that are stolen all the time. So you need to figure out how you're going to protect yourself.
Yeah. On the automation, I think a couple of companies in Bangalore are actually trying to automate this whole thing of like certain dishes. So I know somebody is doing it with four or five dishes like poha, upma, and all of that, and they're placing these vending machines where you could just press a button and it'll cook poha. I've actually eaten out of this one of these vending machines in Bangalore again. This is where the Amazon office is, where there was a huge vending machine. I think it was a combination of pre-cooked, heated up, and stuff like that. But it was just a vending machine where you could order full-blown biryanis and, you know, like different kinds of Indian cuisine, which I didn't think was possible in a vending machine. But I've eaten out of one, and it was extremely fascinating. Probably 5-7 years down the line, 10 years down the line.
How was the food though?
Yeah, exactly. How was it?
I mean, it wasn't out of the world, but it wasn't bad either, right? It was like, if you're in the canteen during your work day, you just want decent, good quality food. You're not looking for like out of the world food anyway, so it works.
But also, how good can veg biryani be?
I guess, yeah, that's true.
So semi-automation's already entered the industry. So there's this startup in the US, I forget its name, but they have a machine called Flippy, and its job is just to flip burger patties. And their whole business model is to convince like a McDonald's that basically we can increase the number of burgers you can produce per hour because you have perpetual demand anyways. It's only about that. But the sushi thing is huge. I mean, there are a lot of Japanese restaurants which have sushi automators, and it's a massive, massive business.
The thing in India is that labor is always cheaper than capital. So unless that flips around at some point of time, a lot of these automations will take time to enter India until that machine gets much cheaper.
Did you guys sort of see the video of this roti making machine, like Rotimatic or something like that, back in the day? I don't know where they are right now, but it got viral at that point in time, and they were selling the machine for like $1,500 or something. It'll be interesting to see where they are at right now.
You know how dishwashers had like a massive jump in demand during COVID, right? I'm 100% sure the same thing happened with rotis.
Yeah. 100%.
Nobody's reporting about it, but I'm 100% sure that would have happened.
Yeah. Sahil, next episode, we'll come back with Rotimatic's numbers, or just Roti Makers, and see what's out there.
Okay. So let's move on to the last idea. Do you have one, Siddharth?
Yeah. So book clubs have existed for, you know, decades now, where people get together and they try to read one common book and then discuss what was written in the book. We actually started a TID book club very recently, our first one. We're going to see how that experiment goes. But now online courses are extremely popular, right? In the online courses, there are two buckets. One, which is self-paced, which is, you know, what the industry called as MOOCs. These are, you can do it at any point in time. Coursera, Udemy caters to this market. And then on the other end, there's cohort based courses, which is a bunch of people coming together with a live instructor and going through a paced program for 2 months, 3 months.
And these are much smaller, right? They're like 20, 30 people. Yeah.
Yeah. The problem with cohort based courses are expensive, and you don't find it for all the topics that you're looking for. And the self-paced ones, the completion ratio is just shit. Like it's like less than 10% or something like that, right? What if you could make course clubs, which is a bunch of people coming together, saying that we want to take this course together. It's available on Coursera for a very little amount of money or even free. And we'll go through this together. So there's accountability. There's people you can sort of discuss ideas with. There are people where if you're stuck somewhere, you can have somebody else explain it to you. So recreating that college environment of sorts at a very low cost by just setting up this course clubs. And it could be a very Craigslist type website or even a feature for these you know, Udemy's and Coursera's of the world, where you say that if you want to join a course club, pay this amount of fee, and then we'll put you together in a close course club that can be mediated and stuff like that. I think it should be done. I think studying together with people is a much better experience than studying alone.
I think you should. Why should Coursera create this platform of getting people together? You know, you should build an app like Tinder, where you can swipe on people's profiles and you can decide who's cool enough to be a part of my clique or my gang who's going to take this course together. You create these micro communities, and you know, that's your way of looking at things.
Sajal, we have realized that everyone we get on the show who's single comes up with some kind of Tinder idea. Every single time it's like, oh, this is the problem, turn it into Tinder.
I'm engaged, so I'm not single.
But I think the way you could take this idea forward of these course-based courses is pick a certain topic. Like, let's say that you're an HR professional and you want to learn everything about HR, but you're not able to, you know, like give the time or the attention or whatever. So you just join a HR-focused course-based course or club. And then the entire club decides together, like, okay, first we're going to do this HR course. Next, we're going to do this HR course. Next, that one. And I think if it's topical, people will stay in there for much longer. While if it's like constantly, like new person comes in, goes out, it'll become a lot more confusing, in my opinion. Also, if it's topical and the people stay together for a long time, there'll be a lot more sharing. There'll be a lot more conversation, and you can meet once a month and you can discuss like, oh yeah, this was my main learning from this course, etc., etc.
100%. I think one of the things that's going to get extremely popular is continuous learning at workplaces. I don't think it was as popular back in the day, where you could graduate with a certain skill and then you could go 10, 15, 20 years without your career being disrupted per se. But how fast things move now because of technology, you have to sort of keep updated with everything. And I like this idea of like being in a club, which is not part of like a particular course, but just a broad topic, right? For example, I'm extremely fascinated by blockchain right now, and I want to learn more about it. And I want to see if I can learn some like basic level of programming and stuff like that within blockchain. If I could come together with a group of people who's trying to learn this together, it'll be fantastic. It'll be it'll keep me accountable, and it'll give me a group to sort of bounce off ideas with.
But how this is a question from my end. Like, when I was offered continuous assessment classes at the workplace, I didn't have the time to do it, and I wasn't actively encouraged, because you know, when you think from a business owner's perspective in high attrition industry like investment banking, they'd rather get the output from you for 2 years and then get you to bounce, right? So really, what are the subsectors that would find this, where the corporate itself finds it useful to get their employees to reskill and upskill? Given even tech companies are like, engineers bounce every year. That's the way you make money in engineering. You go get a new signing bonus, you stay for a year, 2 years, let your options vest, and you bounce and move to the next startup. So who does this really work for?
I think personally, looking at this, I think this is not something that you'll make money out of. Like even book clubs, there are very few book clubs in the world that make money. I think this is something that like very high achieving people come together so that they can learn. That's how I am seeing it. I don't know if Siddharth, you had some monetization idea.
The only way I think you could monetize it is if you give them a platform to collaborate, which has partnerships with different sort of courses where you can bring the courses on this platform. That's one way to do it. But I would just start off with like a Craigslist type website, very basic, just saying that if you want to learn blockchain, here are some people that are interested, and just go out and do that. So going back to the question, I think it's very hard to drive it through corporate, 100%. I think it's going to be very evident in the next few years that it's going to be the individual's responsibility to keep upskilling, right? Because what's going to happen in the next 4 or 5 years is people who are, let's say, 38, 40, and who haven't really invested in upskilling are going to get disrupted by much younger talent. And they'll be like, okay, what happened, right? And this happened in the IT services boom. I don't know if you guys know, 2, 3, 4 years back, there were a bunch of 40, 45-year-olds that were just laid off by a lot of these IT services companies when they were trying to cut costs, right? And they had no place to go to because they'd been dated from, like, you know, the technologies that they knew and stuff like that. They never invested that time. So it at some point has to be self-motivated. With that said, I do think you can tap into some younger companies which hire a lot of fresh talent or like young talent to say that, hey, you'll need to train them regardless of the fact that they're bouncing somewhere else or not, because chances are if you invest in training and if you have a good culture, they might just stick around. So even if like a subset of 20-30% people stick around, that's still good enough, but go out and train them.
I actually was having this conversation, exact same conversation, with one of our listeners yesterday, Atin, if you're listening, right now I'm trying to write the thesis for what our private community would be, the private community for the Indian Dream. And one of the main things that I wrote in that thesis was that a lot of entrepreneurs, they don't have a learning and development schedule. Like, they don't know what their learning and development is going to be over the next 6 months to a year and stuff like that. So I personally, and especially this is true for the SME segment, and especially this is true for the family management business segment. I think this is a gap that the TID private community can fill. And this is what I'd written, and this is a conversation I had with Atin also yesterday, is that he was also saying that if I were to join a private community, I would want this gap to be filled. I would want my learning and development to be fulfilled by this community. And I think that, in fact, we should convert our book club into this instead of book reading, because it seems now it's a little dated. People are struggling reading the book. People don't get the time. But instead, if you're just watching a video for an hour, I think that's kind of easier. We should go back, have a conversation with our book club and be like, guys, maybe we should do a course-based club instead.
I think L&D is one of those things when you get in the thick of things of your day-to-day work, like you said, Sajal, when you were just doing investment banking stuff, you won't find the time to do this. Even for entrepreneurs, they get into the operational stuff and they never have the time to sort of pull back and sort of just reevaluate things and learn new things. But extremely critical now. I think that could be a differentiator between you as a business, especially a small and medium business, staying ahead of the curve and, you know, adopting a lot of these platforms that are coming up by just staying updated and learning about what's happening in this world, right? Because I know people benefited out of Udaan, people benefited out of Zilingo, people benefited out of Meesho by just being early movers into that space.
You know what? Once a community of folks who would actually find this super interesting and people who have a history of actually upskilling and reskilling themselves is the freelance community. So, you know, when you're talking about disruption of people getting laid off, the first example that came to my mind is social media marketing. I don't want to hire, for my startup, I don't want to hire an agent. I want to hire that 17, 18-year-old kid who's got a grip on what to do in the social media landscape. And what have they done? They've done a Google digital ads course, they've done the Facebook free course, and they're set, right? I understand that, you know, to get that 1% increase in skills, they probably have to do a lot more work and a lot more experience. But you're 70, 80% of the way there based on the kind of folks that we've also worked with. So for the freelance community where their bread and butter is decided on how relevant and up-to-date they are, like, I think this could be great for them.
I agree. 100% agree. I think that's a niche that you could target to start these course-based clubs. The jury is out on how you'd make money, but it's an interesting product to build.
I mean, if you can create the communities, right, that's where you monetize it. So that means you found a community of highly motivated folks. That is monetizable in so many different kinds of ways. That's like what Cred is doing, right? Is they found a community of people who can pay their credit card bills on time. Now what they can do with it is unbelievable.
Yeah, 100%. audience first products, basically. Build an audience, build a community, and then figure out what products and services to build for them. Thank you so much, Sajal. Thank you so much for taking time out. I love reading the Boring News Co. I've been following it since we spoke, and I love the no nonsense, no bullshit news, just to the point. So keep doing what you're doing, and thank you for taking time out.
Thank you for inviting me, guys.